This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 6th, 2019. Current federal tax developments is brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm broadcasting again this week from Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix still staying below 100, so we'll cross our fingers for a while. And we're still, you know, here in the spring of Phoenix, so makes for interesting. And this week, we've got a few things happening. We're going to go through a court case where a taxpayer discovered a new form of marriage penalty. Actually, not really new. We've known about this. We've seen it now. But it involves the premium tax credit and how getting married late in the year ended up costing a taxpayer over $4,400. We'll talk about a case this week where they tried a different approach, the taxpayer did, to arguing why a refundable state tax credit in excess of the amount that they owed in state taxes shouldn't be taxable to them. Didn't win on that one, but still tried. The IRS did take steps they'd promised to us earlier to begin to expand the determination letter program for qualified plans to apply to, in this case, a limited subset of existing plans. The IRS has indicated they plan to open the program to more existing plans after cutting it way back previously. And we'll talk about the problem this week and what's kind of our headline version of an LLC operating agreement that effectively terminated an S corporation's S status because it turns out it created a second class of stock, which, as we all know, not a good thing. Well, I did my road traveling. Like I said, I've been to, as I mentioned before, Atlanta, Georgia. I will be coming up to Portland, Oregon on the 16th of this month. And in Portland at Beaverton, actually in Beaverton, Oregon, I will be presenting actually a FASB and AICPA and accounting in general update for 8 hours up there. So it'll be a little different than what we cover on this course. But, you know, we have to worry about that, too. Accounting standards are in place. So that's coming up. If you're in the Oregon, Portland, Oregon, Erica, I'll be heading up there. Going to also, I believe, be doing some work for a chapter meeting for the New Jersey Society of CPAs in Somerset. I'll be telling you a little bit more about that as we get closer, but we'll be doing some stuff there. Let's go ahead then and take a look at our first case for this week. And this case is the case of Fisher versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2019-44. The case was actually issued, the decision was issued on April the 30th of 2019. And this case involves the advance premium tax credit. So the idea here is the taxpayer had gone. She was unmarried. So this particular case involved the taxpayer in this case, who was an unmarried woman who went to the exchange, Christina. And Christina went to the exchange and she gave them her information about her earnings, her income, and that information. And the exchange determined that she qualified for a credit, an advance premium. She qualified for a premium credit they expect at the end of the year. And so for that reason, because the whole purpose of the premium credit was to encourage her to buy insurance and to subsidize the health insurance, under the rules of the program, she is able to get an advance payment of that against each month's premium payment. So she writes a much smaller check, and the amount that represents her credit goes with her payment to the insurance company to pay for the insurance she's getting. So Christina had been determined that she was going to get about $4,400 worth of credits throughout the year. That was divided by 12, and every month that was basically sent on. In mid-November of this year, in mid-November of the year in question, Christina essentially went and she got married. Okay. She got married to a spouse who had significantly more income than Christina did. They filed a joint return, which actually doesn't really change this, but they did. So they're joint, they get married. The catch is the premium tax credit's not available to taxpayers whose household income is in excess of 400% of the federal poverty level. This gentleman that she married, his income was high enough that their joint income ended up going beyond that level for their family size. And so for that reason, they didn't qualify for the credit. Now, there is a relief provision of sorts in the law. The relief provision of sorts says that if you get married during the year, we go back and we calculate for each of them on their own prior to the date of marriage. We use their household size and the like. But the problem is we still have to take their household income for the year and divide that out. And when Christina is assigned half of the household income, she still fails. So at the end of the day, regardless, you know, calculating the alternative method, the regular method, Christina owes the entire $4,400 back. Now, Christina said, you know, that just seems like unfair. I mean, you are retroactively wiping out a credit that I would otherwise have clearly qualified for. And there's no question. Had she been unmarried the entire year, had she not had that household with an individual whose income was way higher, she would have qualified for this credit. And certainly for 10 months of the year, she was not a member of that household. She did not have that additional income. But we were still going back and penalizing her for the entire year. And her argument was, well, that's just frankly unfair. And the problem is, as the tax court said, despite the fact they were sympathetic to her issue, they're not a court of equity. And they can't ignore the law. The law itself requires this treatment. The law itself says that you have to pay back this credit if your household income exceeds a certain amount. The tax court had no option but to say, look, they didn't disagree it was calculated correctly. They didn't disagree with the amount she got. They didn't disagree with the 1095A issued by the exchange. With all of those in play, no disagreement on any of those items, the tax court said there's really nothing we can do in order to grant you relief. Because unfortunately, in a case like this, relief just isn't available. There is no option for relief in this case. Next up, another taxpayer who this time, though, was taking a different run on a matter we'd seen before. This is the case of Ginsburg versus Commissioner. It was an appeal of a case that was decided by the Court of Federal Claims. So it's at the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It is case number 1:17CV00075RHH. It was also issued on April the 30th of 2019. The facts in this case are similar to facts in a case we discussed back in 2015 in the predecessor version. I guess it is still the same podcast, you know, and videocast, but it was back in the days when this was a Nichols Patrick podcast. We had discussed the case of Maines versus Commissioner. And in the Maines case, we had a situation where a taxpayer in New York had earned and received tax credits that were refundable by the state, and that the state labeled as being a state tax refund, income tax refund. He had said, well, you know what, I had an itemized, so therefore, you know, it's non-taxable. The tax court said, sorry, I don't care what the state of New York calls it. The reality is this was an accession to wealth. They were not paying or reducing your tax to the state of New York. They were rather giving you money. Giving you money is an accession to wealth. There was no other exclusion to take it out under. Therefore, it's taxable. Now, this case, first thing is, didn't go to the tax court. And secondly, decided to argue a little different rule. In this case, the taxpayer in this case received credits that were brownfield redevelopment tax credits, again, from the state of New York. The state of New York seems to be the one popular to go after these things. So you had these brownfield redevelopment tax credits. They were in excess of the tax owed. He had not reported that excess amount as taxable income on his return. Now, he didn't try to argue, as Maines did, that this was a state income tax refund and was non-taxable for various reasons. He said, no. He decided to try this a little differently. Even though he didn't report it, he's now saying, well, that this really isn't taxable because we got this credit for doing certain work, redeveloping and redoing the land. And because of that, we think in this case that really the state of New York was merely reimbursing us for work to clean out that land. And it's a more interesting argument. But the court of claims had a problem with it, and so did this court. The problem, they said, was really the credit, you know, you think it's a reimbursement of capital. But in reality, the credit did not really require, they didn't give you money based on how much you spent. They gave you money based on doing certain things and maintaining certain standards, but it was not saying that, you know, for, you know, if you spend $500, we're going to give you $500. That wasn't how the credit was handled. Rather, it was a straight accession to wealth as long as you, you know, took the steps involved, and it didn't really worry about how much you spent. Or, you know, it wasn't the sort of thing in the case that the state of New York was trying to, you know, basically underwrite your cost of doing this work. Unlike the taxpayer we had in the last case, where it's pretty clear under, you know, the premium tax credit is meant to clearly pay for those premiums, and you only get it if those premiums, you know, are paid. So it's, and, you know, we, and if it turns out the insurance company says next month, you know what, we really think your premiums are too high, you only really have to, we're only really going to charge you a quarter of that, you're not going to still get the same credit. That wasn't going to be the case here. They just had to maintain certain standards. If they did, then, you know, if they did maintain those standards, they'd get to keep the money. Well, the problem, the court said, is that's effectively still an accession to wealth. And under Section 61 of the code, generally, accessions to wealth are automatically considered taxable income unless they are excluded by some of the provision. This improved their net worth by getting this credit. And yes, they had to go buy this thing to get it. But the reality was that, you know, they essentially got the, they got this credit, and it was not directly tied to, you know, how much money they spent to do these things. They got full title of the land. They weren't really otherwise restricted about the land. It's their land. So the theory being, or it's their property. So the reality was, they said, hey, no tax, you know, the tax refund is taxable income. Next up, a thing the IRS had kind of promised us was coming, Revenue Procedure 2019-20, that was issued on May the 1st, 2019. This represents a expansion of the IRS's determination letter program for qualified retirement plans, okay? Now, a determination letter gives us some comfort, gives us actually significant comfort, that our qualified plan document is not, does not itself have document problems that would make it non-compliant with the requirements for a qualified retirement plan under Section 401 or ERISA. And that's useful because obviously if we don't have a qualified retirement plan, then we don't get any of the magic benefits of those plans, which includes full deduction to the employer when the money goes in, no inclusion income by the employee when the money goes in. It doesn't end up generally affecting payroll taxes if it's employer contribution, not deferral. We can do those 401k deferrals. Got all this magic that can be done, but this magic requires that our plan document be in compliance with the requirements of ERISA and Section 401 of the Internal Revenue Code. So the IRS will give you that blessing if you send your plan in and pay a fee. But they have cut back dramatically on how they do it. I remember years ago when I first started in account, in basically in tax accounting, I was here in Phoenix, Arizona. Most CPA firms at that date were handling a bunch of qualified retirement plans. That was a really, really big thing in Phoenix at the time. And most of those plans were not 401ks. They were fully employer funded. And there were, you know, various reasons why 401ks just didn't work for closely held businesses very well at all at that time. So basically, we had very, very few plans that were, you know, were those. They were all straight profit sharing plans. And so at the time, I did a bunch of 5500s in my early years in practice. Had a bunch of these things. And documents have to be updated when the law was changed. And the law got changed quite a bit that time too, because your document has to be updated to be current. And traditionally in those days, you would send, because we did mainly customized plans, or at least quasi-customized plans, you'd send them in for a new determination letter when you did these major changes. And that program continued over the years in various forms. But the IRS finally decided that, you know, it was, that was too burdensome and a problem for them, even with the user fee. So they cut back and limited their program generally for customized, for basically for, you know, self-developed plans to new plans and plans that were being terminated. If you are making amendments during the other interim periods, if the law changed and you had to modify the plan or you otherwise modified the plan, You just had to hope that your modifications were good enough the service didn't want to waste time doing it. Due to complaints, they've now backed off on that somewhat. Now, beginning in September, they will allow applications for two types of situations. Number one, if you have a statutory hybrid benefit plan. That's kind of a long way of saying cash benefit defined benefit plan, a cash balance defined benefit plan. It's a hybrid because it's based on a deemed existing account is what you do, but it's a defined benefit plan. So those types, there have been some changes, and there were significant regulations issued, you know, not terribly long ago after a number of these plans already been in place, and nobody could get a termination letter on that because, you know, their plan couldn't qualify since it wasn't brand new, wasn't being terminated. Now those plans can be submitted for a termination letter, which means the IRS can review the plan language against what the law now requires, and you will have an option to hopefully fix anything that's not quite right. They also have allowed a case where plans are merged. We have a lot of acquisitions have gone on. I mean, especially in the tech industry, there's been a ton of acquisitions that have gone on. And most of those old companies, you know, the two separate companies, each probably had their own retirement plans. And when we merge those companies, we most often would like to combine the retirement plans into a single plan so that we're not running, you know, if you've acquired a bunch of companies, you know, and companies like Google and Apple have acquired many companies over the years. You know, they don't want to have 42 different, you know, retirement programs that apply to different groups, you know, that are pre-existing plans. So we want to try to merge these plans into one centralized plan, hopefully to simplify administration. Well, up to now, if you did that, you again were hoping you got it right because it wasn't a new plan. So they wouldn't rule on that. Now they will, again, beginning in September, if you have a merge plan, they'll rule on it. Here's the catch, though. We've been doing these for quite a while. So what happens if we send it in now for blessing, and it turns out they come back and say, oh, no, that provision, not good, need to be changed. We've been running with that provision for a few years. You know, are we in trouble? Are we going to get hit with big sanctions? Are we going to even maybe lose qualification? And the answer is no. The IRS also added relief provisions in here that will extend the period to fix problems with remedial amendment periods. And remedial means we can make them effectively quasi-retroactively after taking certain actions to solve the problems. And we're not going to face sanctions for that situation. To clean up issues, presumably issues that we're going to find when we send these plans in that previously we weren't allowed to send in. The IRS now says, well, we got this issue with it, and we're not going to give you a blessing letter until such time as you clean this up. You know, you've now basically shown them all the dirty laundry, and that would seem to be somewhat unfair since they now could come in and examine the plan. So we now have a bit of relief. That's kind of good news for us. The IRS has also stated, they've implied that this is just step one. They are hoping to expand the determination letter program even more. So if you're like me, you're back from the days when it was just normal to get termination letters for most anything. You know, you may very well feel much better about this option, especially if you have these customized plans. You know, you're in a large organization that's customizing plans. So you'd love to be able to get these termination letters. Now, apparently, we're going to have a better option to get those. Let's go to what got a lot of discussion, at least on Twitter, when I posted this week. And this is a private letter ruling, 2019-18-004. It came out on Friday. You know, it's one of those things. Now, it's kind of funny. Years ago, I used to share doing this podcast with Lynn Nichols. And you know, Lynn would always get his private letter rulings by looking at the posts that used to be released by tax analysts on Monday, was his service he'd use. And I was always going to the IRS website and going through their weird side links, irs.gov/pub. And you get there a link now that's actually a little bit nicer than it used to be to get there. But you can get the PLRs like on Friday when the IRS posts them up rather than waiting until Monday when your tax service posts them. Now, in the interim, what's happened is tax analyst has moved their publication date for the Monday stuff. They release it on the web on Saturday. And you know, it's, and the IRS has been a little more iffy with how those post, but I still get stuff there. And today, you know, this time I got there Friday morning, and actually the first one I looked at was this ruling. It's like, well, this is neat, because I haven't talked about this for a while. And it turns out that maybe a lot of people hadn't thought about this. We have here a limited liability company that elected to be an S corporation under the check the box rules. The PLR is not clear about how this happened and what kind of operating agreement it had at that point, what members it had, various things. In any event, though, on another date, that's a date other than the S election, so apparently we amended the operating agreement. It's not clear. You know, the ruling really isn't clear how this did. But we adopted an operating agreement, and this operating agreement had in it some language that, you know, you probably seen in a whole bunch of LLC operating agreements over the years. And what it says is, basically, the private letter ruling summarizes it this way, that Section 10 of the operating agreement provided that upon dissolution of the company, got nice ellipses there, we have some things added here, the proceeds from liquidation of the company's assets shall be distributed to the members in accordance with their respective positive capital account balances, and the balance, if any, to the members in accordance with their respective percentage interest. Now, you know, you read that and you say, well, here it goes. We've got everything's going to their capital account balances. Well, that's one of the requirements to have substantial economic effect under Regulation 1.704-1B1 for a partnership agreement. And that's why it's pretty standard language that we're going to see in a lot of LLC operating agreements. If you just go grab one off the internet somewhere, boilerplate, people are known to do that. You know, you just grab this boilerplate document, or, you know, or the attorney who doesn't work a lot with S corporations, maybe the attorney wasn't even aware you're planning to use an S corporation. You're going to do an S election on this thing. So there is this nice vanilla LLC operating agreement that is formed. Well, here's our problem. That is a partnership provision. And the hitch goes to, and the under for S corporations, we look at Internal Revenue Code Section 1362B, one of the requirements to be an S corporation is an S corporation can only have one class of stock outstanding. Now, the definition of class of stock for an S corporation is a little different than the definition you'd see under state law. And this definition also has to be expanded to cover the concept of an LLC operating agreement and member interest. An LLC doesn't issue stock. So we're in this weird world of trying to figure out how to make this work and how it fits. So we have an odd definition of second class of stock, because, by the way, second class of stock, voting rights aren't considered as class of stock, while for state law purposes, that's probably considered one of the most significant indications that you have multiple classes of stock. Under corporate law, there's no different rights to vote. That's kind of a big deal. Not a big deal for the S corporation rules. Rather, for the S corporation rules, the key issue here is whether your stocks have, stock is considered to be a single class of stock if each share of stock. For LLC, we've got to kind of make this kind of glob, this unit that we're going to look at. So for each interest piece, whatever that piece might be. And I hate to use units because a lot of agreements will call that. That's not necessarily what it calls a unit, may not be the same as what we're going to consider a unit for this purpose. So just be aware, I'm going to call it this glob, this glob that is our ownership, you know, piece in the LLC, that each piece, however we do them on a quote per share basis, so we've got to break them into equal size things that are per share, that each one of those pieces always has identical rights, and the key word in that there is rights, to distributions and liquidation proceeds. Okay. Now, this is important because a couple of things to note there. The regulation you're going to find that does this is found at Regulation 1.1362-1L1, is where the regulation tells us what a single class of stock is. We are only concerned with rights, and we're only concerned with issued, you know, types of ownership that are issued and their rights. If under any condition, and this is what's important, if under any set of conditions, there might end up being either a right to a distribution not in accordance with that, you know, per piece status, or there might be a right in liquidation to a distribution not in accordance with that per piece situation. You do not have an S corporation because those pieces are considered to be multiple classes of deemed stock. Now we run into our problem in this case. That language didn't say each piece got the same. Rather, it looked to the substantial economic effect provisions of the partnership for 704 regulations to say that we look at their capital account, which, at least in theory, does not have to be the same as their, you know, as their per piece interest. So because there is a possibility, even if unlikely, and by the way, nobody has ever said this LLC ever made a distribution that wasn't pro rata, or that actually even liquidated today, the distribution wouldn't be pro rata. But because of that possibility, if certain things happen, that a distribution might not be pro rata, that right problem is enough to kill it. Now, flip side of that is, as you'll find, and actually the people at the service that rule on these things will tell you the same thing. If somebody makes a disproportionate distribution, not because the, you know, and they do it even though the documents say you can't, as long as there's no other agreement where the other people give up their right to the catch-up distribution, you know, or they have it, and whether that right is formal or is just effective, wink, wink, you haven't terminated the agreement. Because rights are what matter, not what happens. How's that for? I mean, in many cases, S corporations are way form over substance. It's true here. It's true in debt, you know, guarantees of debt. We see a lot of that. Form is way elevated over substance in guarantee, you know, in terms of allocation of debt basis. It has to be, you know, loan from the shareholder to the corporation. That's key. It doesn't matter. You guarantee it doesn't count, right? Same problem. So, you know, form over substance doesn't always win. You know, I should say form over substance in this case wins out. So the problem was the day that this partnership adopted this agreement, they terminated their election. Didn't realize it, but they did. Now, here's the problem. Somewhere down the line, we're reviewing the agreement. Why would we be reviewing this agreement afterwards? You know, like a couple of years down the line. Well, quite often it's because somebody is looking at buying the S corporation. They may be wanting to acquire the stock. Sometimes that's true. Are we trying to set up a tax-free deal because they're trying to acquire it? They want to do it tax-free because they want to issue stock. You know, this will be a stock-for-stock exchange. We can do the reorganization, etc. That would all work great. And I've actually had that happen with S corporations. Or even if they acquire the assets, they're worried, you know, that if that corporation has this big liability out there, that they might somehow get tainted with that if they're deemed to have basically, you know, taken all the assets of the company and allowed them to scurry off. You know, they allowed them to perpetrate a fraud against U.S. government. So quite often the buyer is going to send in a due diligence team. That due diligence team will review documents, and that due diligence team probably would not surprise me. That's how this came up, was reviewing this operating agreement and ran into that paragraph and said to the buyer, well, here's the catch. They have this in the agreement. That creates a second class of stock almost without question. So arguably, this thing has not been an S corporation for, let's say, whenever they adopted this 10 years ago. So for the last 10 years, this has not been an S corporation. Should have been filing 1120s, and it should have been paying corporate level tax. It reported no income. You know, it paid no tax. These liabilities have been running for all this time. And there'll be this humongous liability that would be way now in excess of their assets. So tough luck, you know, basically we can't, you know, if you buy this, you're taking a huge risk. And the buyer generally goes back and tells the seller or what was going to be the seller that you need to fix this or we can't buy you. You know, we're going to have to pass on the deal. So that's how these things quite often come up. Well, good news, it can be solved. You go to the IRS. The IRS has the right to waive inadvertent terminations. And that's the argument what happened here. This termination was inadvertent. We fouled up. You know, we accidentally, you know, dropped the ball and we don't have an S corp, but we were never aware of it. There was no bad intent, et cetera, et cetera. So you go to the IRS, and the IRS very regularly issues these, you know, private letter rulings saying, okay, yeah, we agree that that's inadvertent. But the problem is you have to go to them because your U.S. election has been terminated unless you've gotten this, you know, okay, you know, you have now been forgiven letter from the IRS. If you don't have that letter, you don't have an S-Corp. So you can't just ignore the problem. And secondly, you have to pay the user fee to get the letter, and the letter has to be walked through the process at the IRS national office to get the relief granted. And of course, the catch is quite often, you know, now we don't trust the, you know, we don't trust the advisors that caused this mess up. So quite often you'll see that the entity that's going to go and offer to apply for this ruling on their behalf is the due diligence team, which quite often is from a very large national accounting or law firm, and is charging those levels of fees. And they're charging them back to the seller, but of course now the seller is thinking that my advisor should be paying this. So the problem here is it's a very expensive lesson about the care needed when using an LLC as a vehicle for an S corporation. It's a very, very dangerous thing. In fact, I've talked in the past, I was on the conference agenda in the past with somebody who actually did for a national and a big four firm, had been doing due diligence work in the S corporation arena. And she quipped in one sense, and I've heard this from other sources too, people that work in this area, that their view is there's no such thing as an S corporation. There's just something that used to be an S corporation, but blew their election in the past. The theory being almost every S corporation eventually blows her election. S's are extremely, extremely fragile. They are very easy to blow the election. And once the election's blown, you've got to get this private letter ruling to get it back. This means A, take real care with your S clients to make sure we don't have problems like second class of stock, non-resident alien shareholders, that if we have trust, they are QSST or ESBTs, those are things we see problems with all the time, that we don't get shares put in a partnership, that we don't get shares held by a corporation that's not an S corp that holds 100%, we make a Q sub election. You know, check all these problems. Secondly, when you take over a new S corporation client, you need to kind of do your own due diligence research on what's happened in the past to make sure if you catch it now, then you're at least not exposed down the line when, you know, a third party comes in and says, oh, by the way, this thing was not an S corporation. You know what? You know, the CPA that I know you switched CPAs in 2016. Well, really, that CPA should have told you about this. So, you know, your 16, 17, 18 returns that were done, well, that was really negligent. They didn't do those as C corp returns, and or they didn't tell you to go back and get this waive. So we'll take care of that problem, but you know how that works. So just be really, really careful. You know, the fragility of the S corp has been a problem for years. I have told people for a long time that, you know, there's a lot of issues with S corps that we just kind of ignore because normally we don't see them. The service doesn't tend to raise this issue easily on exam, but in due diligence, that doesn't matter. Due diligence is worried about what they could do, and therein lies our problem. It is, again, early in the CPE registration season. Now is the time to go in and register. Registering now helps everybody, you know, figure out, you know, how the year is going to go. I'll just warn you ahead of time. It's important so that we all know, you know, if in fact there's going to be enough people for courses to occur. That sometimes happens. It turns out there's only four people. Well, so maybe we can't hold a course for four people. And that happens at times because it just won't pay for the airfare. The downside, though, is if you wait till like the week before, 2 weeks before to register for a course, hey, we got enough people to do it. Because we didn't know that, none of the airfare, none of the travel could be booked in. Yeah, that also hurts. And so it dries up the number you need, which, yeah, it's kind of a mess. Also, for those of you in Arizona, please remember, you don't register by the end of May, you lose your early sign-up discount. So it's also kind of important for those of us here in Arizona that we want to do that for that. Your state societies have a bunch of options. There's a lot that happened during tax season. You really want to go in now and get some more information in place. And by the way, as I said, I'm teaching an A&A course. You know, we're in the middle of the three big, you know, changes that came down from FASB. We're in the middle of implementation. When you're a public company or a private company, we're in different stages of those. But you've got all those things to take a look at. You know, now's the time to go take a look, plan your CPE for the year and sign up. Your state catalogs are online. And for those that print them, most of the print catalogs are also out in the mail. So take a look, see what's happening, sign up. I look forward to seeing you guys. You know, I've got courses coming up in New Jersey in June. I've got them in New Jersey in June. I've got them in Phoenix in June. You know, we've got them, and actually in Tucson in June. I've got one preparing complex returns. We'll also talk about 109 Cap A. Be down in Tucson doing those. So be aware, some of those are going to be webcast. So, you know, you may want to check into that too, if you can sit in the home, sit in your office and watch these. So let's talk about, again, our updates are always found online at currentfieldtaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfieldtaxdevelopments.com. Twitter handle, @edzollers, and, you know, we post things there. We get into discussions there. The S-Corporation ruling, as I said, generated a series of responses on that in that level. I also follow various discussions. The Reddit one I mention every week, reddit.com/r/taxpros. That one's open to anybody who wants to get in there. It is moderated, and they do a pretty good job of making sure that it's not just a bunch of people asking for free tax advice to go back and do it on TurboTax. You know, so we get a pretty good group there. Also, I monitor the Connect websites for the Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota Society of CPAs. So if you have issues, you can post there, and I'll be watching the posts on those sites. Connect is a system they use for discussion boards. I also follow along on the Yahoo group site run by the California Society of CPAs, CalCPA for short, on Tax Talk. That one is open to any CPA or attorney, any licensed anywhere in the country. So you can also, you have to get permission to get in there, but you can get in, follow those things. Those discussion groups are really, really helpful, especially if you're, let's say, a solo practitioner, you don't have somebody to bounce ideas off of. Those are places to get some ideas. And there's some really very, very, you know, very well qualified individuals in those groups who give over information, who will give answers. And I mean, you follow for a while, you'll figure out who they are very quickly. So if you have an option to follow either those groups I just mentioned, you're a member of one of those state societies, you're going to the California group, because anybody can do that who's a CPA, or check your own state society, see if they have their own discussion groups, and, you know, take a look in there, see what's happening. I found there are various levels of engagement in the various state society groups. You know, some are far more active than others, but still, it's a useful place to go. And by the way, the easiest way to get an active group going in your state is to get involved and actually start posting and discussing things there. It's amazing how tax people like to talk. The minute they find out there's a place to talk and people are talking about things that are happening, they tend to show up. Otherwise, though, wait, we'll see you next week, hopefully, here as we talk about what's going on in current federal tax developments. Remember, we are still awaiting the final regulations on state and local taxes and state tax credits. Those are out there. We are awaiting proposed regulations on agricultural cooperatives and these rules related to, you know, the 109 Cap AG problem. We also have out there, the IRS has proposed regs at OIRA that are going to deal with the 451C rules for revenue conformity, which is half conformity because it's just as fast as under GAAP effectively. That applies to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And I noted there have been two large companies that have been noted on OIRA's website as having had meetings with OIRA in the past couple of weeks on those. So there's a lot of interest there. And we'll take a look at those. When those come down, we'll talk about them, discuss what's happening. And anything else, I'm sure other things will happen over the next couple of weeks. So hopefully we'll see you again next week here on Current Federal Tax Development.